Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for April 19th, 2018, the Slime Ball Edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. We are here at CBS News Radio HQ with our host, who is also the host of CBS This Morning, who is so kindly letting us come and squat here, John Dickerson. Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And it's not just my generosity, it's the generosity of the entire CBS family.
I love the CBS family. Emily
Bazelon of New York Times Magazine. We feel warmly embraced by the CBS family.
Do you think we're the black sheep of the CBS family? We're like the adopted children.
I don't think they notice us. I think we're like the third cousin stepchildren off in the corner.
Who showed up. We showed up for Thanksgiving and no one's sure why we're here.
Okay, here's a plate. Who are you?
Yeah. Maybe we can marry someone important at CBS.
We could work on that, although we're both already married, which is a slight problem. We could offer our children up to be married. How about that?
That's good. An alliance with CBS. In any case, we have an actual GabFest this week. On this week's show, the continuing fallout from the raid on the president's private lawyer, notably the news that Sean Hannity was also a client of Michael Cohen. Then Jim Comey tours the universe and beyond, pushing his new book, condemning the president. Then the Starbucks arrest travesty. What can be done to eliminate the racism and mistreatment against African-Americans who are customers at private businesses. Plus, we're going to have cocktail chatter and a Slate Plus segment to be named later. And we are just 2 weeks out from our St. Louis show. We are going to be live at the Sheldon Concert Hall on Wednesday, May 2nd. There's still a few tickets left at slate.com/live. And we have a great guest, Jason Kander, the Missouri politician, political activist, generally all around interesting and admirable fellow, will be with us at that show. So go to slate.com/live for tickets.
Can I just say
details.
How nice it was of the Missouri governor to get himself into such hot water right in time for our show? We can talk about Eric Greitens like forever when we're in St. Louis.
Yes, I need to learn how to pronounce his name.
I think that's right. But
he'd only be in more hot water if he were in an actual hot tub, which may be where this story is heading anyway.
Sure he's been in hot tubs. Although it's hard to punch somebody when you're in a hot tub, and also you can't take nude photos that show up well in hot tubs because there's all that water. So he might avoid them. He likes dry land.
It could be the case. I think this is a vast landscape for us to explore.
Any case, come on May 2nd, slate.com/live, Sheldon Concert Hall in St. Louis. On Monday, jaws fell, phones were dropped at the news that the third client of presidential lawyer Michael Cohen was, in fact, Sean Hannity, the Fox News commentator and Trump ally, supporter, advisor. Setting aside the weird fact that Cohen only has three clients, because Emily, who is not even a lawyer, probably has You probably have three clients, Emily.
I probably have at least three clients.
It was kind of stunning to discover that Hannity, who had defended Cohen and who had attacked the raid so passionately, was Cohen's own client.
But was it really astounding?
That's the question.
It wasn't really. I'm having trouble, like, taking a sufficient umbrage at this story. Like, it seems highly unsurprising that Hannity would have gotten legal advice from Donald Trump's lawyer because they're pals. And it, not surprising at all that he wouldn't have disclosed it on the air and that Fox wouldn't care. It just seems like, of course, this is the way it is.
Right, well, and I'm the only one of Trump's lawyers that Hannity's hired. Jay Sekulow also worked.
And I won't get up there. I'll go all the way to the depot, which is to say it's a feature, not a bug, which is like for Fox News, for Sean Hannity to have the president's lawyer is, I would think,
until they all wind up in the slammer. No, it's great.
But I think this is great. His job. He's not a journalist. He is an advocate for the president. Arguably the president's strongest advocate. Period. And so not only, of course, would he have these kinds of relationships, but the relationships that he has with both the president and the president's lawyer would seem to me to be in furtherance of his central goal, which is to be the strongest, most forceful advocate for the president and the worldview that he puts forward. So,
and let's not, it's sort of helpful in the sense, like, let's not pretend otherwise. Let's not pretend that Sean Hannity is not a spokesperson for Donald Trump, that there is any separation between the two of them.
That is the interesting part, which is if I were right, and I'm not, I'm seriously trying to, if I were right, then why would he not have boasted about it? Right. If my theory of the case is right, then it would seem to me to be something that Sean Hannity would want to boast about.
Right. On the other hand, if you can defend Cohen with a little bit of distance, if you don't have to tell your viewers that you have a personal stake in protecting his reputation, then you're a more effective advocate for him. Right.
That's a good point.
Should Fox have punished or condemned Hannity? There was not even the lightest tap on a knuckle. There was not the mildest little lash of a leaf of grass whipping him, a blade of grass whipping him. Should they have punished him?
I don't know, but Alan Dershowitz
said
criticized
him on air
to his face, which I thought was a commendable, not on the, like, is he right or is he wrong, but just on the kind of intellectual honesty grounds. I thought that was interesting.
I suppose, although, can we not give Alan Dershowitz too much credit because he is really embarrassing himself in many ways on Fox late.
How is what Hannity does different from the lapdoggery that was prevalent, especially in the early Obama years? There was a lot of media hugging and kissing of Obama and obviously sympathy for Obama. How is this different?
But was there anyone whose show was devoted to being in the tanks to the degree that we see here, where you're promoting false narratives, you're ignoring important news when it's not in your guy's favor?
I don't remember.
I can't think of anything that's parallel.
MSNBC that was as biased as this? I doubt it was as biased, but I think it's degree, not kind.
I don't know. Interesting question. I think we can all, if we had the data in front of us, that would be interesting to go through. I want to just go back to your point, Emily, which is the legal part of this, which is, it's one thing, yes, it's clear he's the president's booster, but the fact that he has legal business of some kind with the lawyer, I don't know. I'm trying to see if there's a different category here, which is not about support for the president. We all know he's a supporter of the president. But since the topic was, I mean, certainly intellectually, forgetting boosterism, intellectually, people should know, because the specific topic you're talking about is what's being found in the office.
Yes, he had conflict of interest.
Yeah.
If you're following
he had a dog in the fight.
If you're filing any rules of journalism, you would disclose that. But he's not following the rules of journalism, as we were just agreeing. So once we're in that territory, maybe there is something useful in having that be clear. Like, Fox is not holding him to any journalistic standards, and now we see that.
So we actually asked GabFest listeners for their questions this week about this topic. Let's listen to this question from Nydia.
If Hannity has said he never retained Cohen as his attorney, does that mean none of his communications are privileged, leaving Cohen with two clients? If so, if Trump's dealings with Cohen were not in his capacity as lawyer, are they also not privileged? Thank you.
Trump's dealings with Cohen, his lawyers are certainly going to argue that they are privileged, right? Now, if Cohen wasn't really acting like a lawyer, then the government, the prosecutors are going to argue that, like, no, if you're being a fixer, that's not real legal work. That's part of why we wanted to see all these communications. And they're going to have an argument about that, about where the parameters are. The Hannity Cohen relationship is sort of perfectly described, where Hannity is essentially trying to have his cake and eat it too by saying, oh, I had very minimal contact. We barely spoke. I barely knew you. Oh, but maybe actually, like, I did hand you $10. And so we were covered. And I should also add, you don't have to pay someone to establish an attorney-client relationship. So Cohen's lawyer is arguing that they did have that as a way of privileging the communication. So the tension here is between Hannity wanting to keep Cohen at arm's length now that he is being investigated in for a variety of crimes, but on the other hand, wanting to keep their communications confidential.
And we should note that the reason one might be embarrassed, and I'm not suggesting this is the reason specifically that Sean Hannity is, but you might find yourself in a position to be embarrassed if Cohen's other two clients used his services for the purposes of fixing their relationship with Playboy bunnies.
Can I go back to one part of the story that is bothering me? I'm not sure it was proper or a good idea for the judge to
that was my next question.
Out Hannity as Cohen's client in open court. I mean, so the fact that there is an attorney-client relationship is not in itself privileged, but usually we treat it as a sensitive piece of information that you don't go around broadcasting. And there were certainly other ways for Judge Wood to find this out and for the prosecutors to make their arguments that didn't involve him being outed in that moment. I don't really think that was a good idea.
I totally agree. There was a very interesting National Review piece by Andrew McCarthy suggesting that this was not the way to go about it, that they could have, it could have been disclosed to Wood, could have
in
been
camera,
disclosed to the judge.
As we say, in chambers.
In chambers. And actually, the thing I didn't understand about it is that Wood seemed to have asked the lawyer, you can say it to me or you can write it down for me, right?
And then the lawyer
just blurted it out.
Right.
But what would have happened had he just simply written it down? Would Wood then have necessarily broadcast it to the world, or could Wood have chosen to keep it close to the vest?
She could have chosen to keep it close. And I wonder if the lawyer just in the moment, you know, people make spontaneous wrong decisions in a moment like that in open court. And it does seem to have had these... Well, I guess it's had consequences. I'm not even really sure, other than everyone talking about it, it has had any consequences.
Well, it's pejorative to Hannity. It does make Hannity, it suggests he has something to hide. It suggests that maybe he's fathering children with Playboy bunnies.
On the other hand, though,
if
he's going to keep expressing outrage about this raid without disclosing the relationship, for those reasons, the public did deserve to know. So there's this funny, I don't think that was the right way for the information to have surfaced, but given the role Hannity is playing, it does seem like we deserve to know about that.
Emily, let me ask you another legal question, which is to say, if Cohen's lawyer inflated the relationship with Sean Hannity for the purposes of trying to win this debate over, and the debate was over whether Cohen got to look at basically the information that was taken from his hotel office and house or where he lives. Could you get in trouble in court for pretending there was a relationship where there wasn't, because Sean Hannity says there was no relationship?
Well, they were talking to each other, so I doubt it. I mean, two things. This argument that Cohen's lawyers tried to make about, we're going to look at everything first before the prosecutors do, I mean, that was ridiculous. Like, they weren't going to win that argument. Come on, please. The government had already met a high standard for conducting the raid in the first place. And then the attorney-client privilege runs to the client. That is to say, it's really not Cohen's to claim. It's Trump's or Hannity's or Brady's. Brady? So that is just like a wrinkle here. I mean, if Hannity really, really said, I've never spoken to you in my life, you're not my lawyer, then I think that could be problematic. Certainly not for getting in trouble, but for Cohen actually getting to protect any of the communications. That's why Hannity didn't go that far.
And also, does I think everybody knows that the attorney-client privilege doesn't exist if you use the lawyer in the furtherance of a crime. So
yes.
If you say, hold my gun while you're robbing the bank, there's no attorney-client privilege there. But if the client, Donald Trump, says he didn't know anything about this agreement, then can there have been an attorney-client privilege, an agreement that was made in his name that he knew nothing about?
I mean, their relationship is more generally covered by the privilege, and we don't usually go around like that specifically picking little things out of it. The issue, though, with the contract that Trump claims he didn't know about is like the contract was supposed to be between him and Daniels. And so if there was no meeting of the minds because he knew nothing about it, it's hard to see how the contract's felt. But I also don't even, I mean, I understand why these contracts and these non-disclosure agreements matter for Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Karen McDougal has now gotten out of her contract because they were facing legal exposure. But right. I feel like these women have already told their stories.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Stormy has some more to say, but right. I'm not sure we're really right. going to learn much more right. for the end of these NDAs.
So the thesis about the Cohen investigation seems to be that it may have removed the ability of the possibility that Trump can stop this investigation, because it's not simply with Mueller directly in the Justice Department or in Justice Department purview, but it's out in the Southern District of New York. Those are the prosecutors who are working on the case. That is a famously independent prosecutor's office. I mean, does the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District does report to the Attorney General and can be fired, and a new one could come in and totally change what they're doing.
But they call themselves the Sovereign District.
It's the Sovereign District.
And there are no parameters. There are no limits on this investigation. There's no letter stipulating any boundaries to it.
Right. So is it, do you think, Emily, that is in fact the case, that it has now escaped the barnyard and is out, you know, roaming around?
I do think that is the case. And I think it changes the significance of the debate over whether Trump should, in his own view, fire Mueller or Rod Rosenstein for that matter. And it also suggests that the exposure that Trump is facing is, multiplied by several fold, because these prosecutors could look into anything.
John, Mitch McConnell this week refused to bring to the Senate floor a bill that would somewhat protect Mueller in the event he was fired by the president. A bill that Democrats and Lindsey Graham and I think Tom Tillis, another Republican senator, have been pushing. The bill does seem it's going to get a vote in the Judiciary Committee, but McConnell's not going to let the full Senate vote on it. There's some outrage from the left about this, but can I just set this question up by saying I kind of sympathize with McConnell. He's taking the bullet on this. He's sort of saying Trump's never going to sign it. It might not be constitutional. The House is not going to pass it. Why should I force my colleagues to take a really difficult vote that's not going to have any effect anyway? So I'm not going to do it.
Right. That'll just anger the president. And it'll, I think you probably.
Wait a second. I mean, that's why he's doing it.
Yeah.
But you think that's okay? I mean,
I think that McConnell is just being realistic in the face of a very difficult situation? Yes, I think it's totally comprehensible.
Realistic.
And also,
yeah, of course he's being realistic.
And also, I don't think Democrats should actually want this bill, because I think the main thing it would do would, as John said, would just be like sticking a spear in Trump. It's a provocation.
This is totally bogus what you're arguing. I completely disagree. It's a provocation. Who cares? Let's provoke the president when he's contemplating doing something that is utterly unacceptable. It's important for the second branch of government to stand up and make that clear. And in fact, Trump is sensitive to these exact kinds of provocations, or we could just say, it's standing up to the bully.
But I think for the purposes of McConnell's position, I think you obviously don't want to poke the president when you need him for the elections. I think from the separation of powers and Congress slowly waking from its supine posture on a variety of different things, I think when the president repeatedly and openly noodles the idea of firing these people who are investigating his behavior on a range of things and the behavior of his associates, I think it is a perfectly reasonable for Congress at least to engage with the idea.
And also,
it's an obvious play
to the base, yeah. right? Like, I get it. It's good for him, but it's not good for the country.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. And I, as somebody who is just so dismayed by Congress's inaction and indifference and inability to do anything, this is yet another example of it that is being made manifest. So yeah,
you're right. We'll give this as 100%. A good example of when we've changed your mind.
All right, last question on this topic, Emily, which is that Trump has now apparently or seems to be backing away from any plan to testify or to speak to Mueller and his investigators. Can he agree not to testify, number one? Number two, if he does decide not to testify, what are the steps that are likely to happen?
He can decide not to testify, and then Mueller has to decide whether to challenge that decision by the president or not. Mueller has very good grounds. He, I think, would win the fight in the Supreme Court based on the precedent we have from the Nixon and Clinton era. But it's not a slam dunk, and it would be a big public confrontation. And Mueller has been thus far trying to avoid exactly those kinds of battles. It would be portrayed by conservative media as a very partisan move to make. From the reporting, it doesn't seem at all clear that Mueller is planning to challenge it if Trump decides not to do the interview. I also feel like this
was...
Why not? Maybe he doesn't really need it that much. I mean, maybe he has so much other evidence about this question of corrupt intent in terms of obstruction of justice, either exonerating Trump or implicating him, that this is like a sort of checking the boxes thing. Sometimes talking to the principal person is like something you do at the end for kind of pro forma reasons, not because you actually are trying to learn anything. Maybe we're in that land.
So before we move on, actually, there's just a point about Hannity that I wanted to go back to. Sorry. One of the things that I find so disturbing about Hannity's refusal to have admitted, not his refusal to have said he was Cohen's client, but his shamelessness about it afterwards. I just feel like the shamelessness, that the main thing that has happened in the world in the last couple of years is the rise of shamelessness. The social opprobrium is one of the most powerful tools. Social opprobrium is much more powerful than laws most of the time. Most of the reasons we don't do things is not because there's a law against it, but because we'd be embarrassed or ashamed to admit it in front of our friends and family or feel that we would be humiliated by it. And if that stops being a tool, if people refuse to feel shame, either because there's a team, they know their team will support them, or because they're a narcissist, it really undermines the whole fabric of society in ways that I didn't quite realize until we got into this point.
And it's contagious.
Yes.
I mean,
it spreads.
It's been extraordinary to watch the things that people will say to protect the tribe. And I think one has to be specific here. The talk about private moral behavior in the context of the Clinton years, Mike Pence, for example, said that the president's private behavior was disqualifying because the president is a moral example for the country. So the situations may not be analogous. Certainly the president's relationship while he was in office is not the same. President Clinton's relationship in office is not the same as President Trump's behavior before. But that distinction between the two should not cause everyone to go mute entirely. And that's just one of the many different ways. There are also, that's a sin of omission, but then there are sins of commission where people who used to feel shame when they said something out loud they knew not to be true, that barrier has dropped, and it's dropped for a variety of people in politics in a way that is still has the capacity to surprise me.
You know, one thing I wonder about as we head toward the 2018 election. So just imagine for a moment a world in which the Republicans pay a real price at the ballot box, which may not happen, but imagine it does. There are going to be so many possible explanations for that, that things like, you know, this kind of lack of shame or Scott Pruitt and his crazy spending habits or Ben Carson's super expensive table, like all of these things that were disqualifying, right, have not disqualified a variety of Trump officials. And it's going to be really hard to know whether that's the reason that the party went down, if in fact that's what happens.
If they do. That's a big if. I mean, if they don't, imagine how much worse it could be also. All right, before we end the segment, I want to thank listeners who wrote in with comments and questions for us about this segment. It was really fun to get your very interesting questions, and we look forward to doing this again in the future and keep doing this and getting questions from you that will excite our brains. And you can also look at the conversation that sparks on Twitter and over on Facebook. Twitter is @SlateGabFest and Facebook is facebook.com/GabFest. All right. So Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. And this week. We're going to talk about the death of First Lady Barbara Bush, the wife of George H.W. Bush, the mother of George W. Bush, the champion of fake pearls, the very tart-tongued and excellently interesting woman. Slate.com/GabFestPlus will get you a membership in Slate Plus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Slimeball Jim Comey hit the circuit this weekend. He kicked off the promotional campaign for his new book, A Higher Loyalty, with a long sit-down with ABC's George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, followed by an endless round of interviews everywhere else with everyone. We appear to be the only outlet he's not speaking to this week. I don't know if we asked. Maybe we should have asked.
I think he's no longer going to be doing the interview with Cats and Ammo.
Oh. Cats and Ammo?
It's a very niche publication.
I object to the picking up of Slimeball. I feel like Trump's
That was supposed to be ironizing in the extreme.
I know, but it just gets it into everyone's brain. We're constantly like doing the work of the bad nicknaming for our president.
Well, that's actually gets to sort of one of the big points about the Comey kickoff. Before we get to the substance of his book, which I would like us to get to, but I'm going to get to the theater of it first. So the principal criticism of the right and the left is that Comey's has a love, or one principal criticism, Comey's love of limelight and his sanctimony are combining to get the better of him. And he's made himself a little bit Trump-like, that even though he is himself clearly a truthful and ethical person, the mere fact of him playing this game at all puts him in the same room as Trump, or in the same, on the same spectrum and zone as Trump, and therefore he is just like Trump, and therefore everyone's the same, when of course he's not.
Well, but in a way, that criticism that you just articulated echoes the challenge he faced when he was FBI director, which is, how do you anticipate, understand the environment in which you are about to do something? And does the environment in which you're trying to do something swamp what you're actually trying to do, which is what he was wrestling with the Hillary Clinton decisions he made, both to have the press conference in which he explained his decision not to move prosecutor, and then his decision 10 days before the election.
I don't know. I sort of feel like I haven't learned anything new from the substance of the book. It's been wholly unsatisfying to listen to Comey make excuses for the poor decisions he made. I think that
Which poor decisions around the Hillary Clinton?
There's a passage in the book about how him objecting to the term mass incarceration that I thought was like ridiculous as well. But his excuse making about his breaking of the rules in publicizing the investigation. I mean, particularly the October intervention.
Man, let's have it out.
Are you defending him?
Yeah.
Do you feel like
I think it's completely defensible.
Okay, so tell me.
If he had decided to keep it quiet, and it comes out after an election in which Hillary Clinton is elected, that they have kept it quiet, it exposes the FBI and the country to a kind of partisan division and fighting that was very obvious to all. It's very predictable what would have happened. And it seems to me utterly reasonable for him to make a decision that this is going to come out. We know it's going to come out. Keeping it secret, although that it would be our normal practice to keep the secret, keeping secret in this particular set of circumstances creates the possibility of a kind of division and poisonousness and damage to the institution I love that would be quite devastating for the institution and for the country. And therefore, I'm going to open it up, even though I know it's going to have and would delegitimize a President Clinton in ways that would be extremely damaging to the country. And therefore, I can see that outcome. I see that I, Jim Comey, in October, see what that outcome would be. And therefore, I'm going to choose the other path, even though the other path has these cascade of effects.
So I would find that more persuasive were it not for the fact that there was another option, which was to actually do some kind of reviewing of these emails. So when Comey wrote that letter on the 27th, he said it was going to take weeks or longer to get any kind of handle on what they said. And that turned out to be utterly and completely wrong. They figured it out within a few days, and it turned out that it was almost all duplicates. If he had just held his horses, he could have learned all of those things. And then the other thing I feel like is lurking in here and bothering.
Again, that's a retrospective analysis. Yes, you could argue.
But it seems like kind of an obvious one. Well, if you're the FBI director. Well, like, let's send some analysts in there.
40,000 emails that they were sitting on 40,000 emails.
And keyword searches, like, he doesn't understand anything about algorithms. Like, come on.
His argument, I think that you're on perfectly, and this is where we're, I think, out of our depth, because we need a technologist in here. Is that what we need? I mean, we certainly don't need a lobotomist.
Can we not have a technologist in here?
No, but I think this is because his argument is that what the reason that this was not just any old emails is that he thought that since intent was key, that the cache that was on Anthony Weiner's laptop contained the early BlackBerry emails in which it might have been possible that she was told, hey, don't do this. And she went ahead and did it. And if that, in fact, were the case, then it would show intent. And it turned out those weren't even on there, right?
Right.
And so the question is that something that could have been known in a relatively short period of time, which would have encouraged the holding of the horses? And I don't know. Do we know that could have been found out quickly?
Well, we know that in the end, very quickly, they went through all of them. So it seems like some technologist gave very bad advice at that moment. And perhaps Comey could have checked into it a little more. But there's another point here that bothers me, because what Comey says about his July press conference, and I think also this letter, is this kind of fear of leaking, right? It was going to come out anyway. Jason Chaffetz had this line to the FBI. Maybe people who were loyal to Giuliani and hated Clinton were disclosing all this information. And what Comey said to Stephanopoulos last weekend was people were going to conclude the system was rigged. But they concluded that anyway. I mean, right after Stephanopoulos played that tape, he has Trump on a campaign stage saying the system is rigged. They were going to do that no matter what. And so this notion that you have to defend the institution against very partisan leakers in the moment seems like a really bad road to go down for the FBI in general. And that is why they have this rule about not disclosing information during the course of an investigation, or, you know, slamming someone when you decide not to indict them.
Does it also matter that he made or says he made a promise to Chaffetz, to Congress, that if he found something that was new and material, he would let them know?
I mean,
that he put himself on the hook. And maybe that's a mistake. He shouldn't have put himself on the hook, but...
Yeah, he should. It was a mistake. Yeah. But also new and material. I mean, again, I don't want to sound too lawyerly, but material. It turned out that those emails in October weren't material, and he didn't really put enough effort into figuring that out.
Emily, I really think it's so easy with the retrospect and the knowledge of what damage has been done and the horror that is the Trump presidency and the continued attack on law enforcement to say that he... Oh, yes, just wait 2 days, wait 3 days. You know, it was 10 days after the election. He was under enormous pressure. I agree, like the bowing and scraping to the demands of a GOP Congress that had made it very clear that it was, you know, they would punish him if he wasn't extremely aggressive about Clinton. That troubles me. I just think like there was one obvious outcome that he knew was going to happen if he kept it quiet. And there was another one which was had much less certainty.
And that involved
if he was open
breaking
about
the rules.
It.
The second one involved breaking the rules of the institution on his own. Now, he has this whole other set of concerns about how he thought that Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, was compromised. And, you know, her meeting with Bill Clinton on the tarmac, like, was a huge blunder on her part, right? I mean, there's a lot of blundering going on. I guess one thing I do perhaps agree with you about is that all of this, as frustrating as I find it, does not make me think that Jim Comey is a man of no integrity, that he did these things for partisan reasons, that he wasn't he didn't have the best intentions of the FBI in his heart. I actually do think all of those things. I just think he made like a dramatically wrong call. And I don't think it's only obvious in retrospect. I think breaking the rules about when you reveal details of investigation, there is a reason those rules were in place. And that's what Rod Rosenstein objected to in the letter he wrote excoriating Comey when Comey got fired. Of course, Rosenstein got played. But
well, he got played. And I thought that was an extraordinary thing in the interview for Comey to say basically Rosenstein acted dishonorably by being the stalking horse for President Trump, which is quite a claim.
It's tough, right? Because we don't know that. I would love to know the inside story of that letter and whether Rosenstein really understood how it was going to be used. Because when I read that letter on the facts, I found it very compelling. It's just that then to kind of turn it into a tool for firing Comey because you want to get him off your back, which Trump has said, said.
However one thinks about those failings, do they color and or remove Comey's ability to have standing to make the other claim he's making, which is about the maintenance of standards in the presidency? And this is the Ben Wittes writes this sentence, which I think is an interesting one. He said, my concern is that an inability to see whatever errors Comey made as the good faith failings of a decent man trying his best under extraordinary circumstances affects the ability to process his interactions with Trump. Do you think that does, both of you, in the world, and should it?
I agree with that sentiment. I am finding it harder to feel in the wake of this publicity tour. I don't think we really learned anything. Maybe I already said that.
Yes, I agree with that.
Right? And it does seem like vain and self-serving and publicity and book selling. It's not the right time for him to be trying to go toe-to-toe with Trump, and it does diminish him in the way it always diminishes people when one by one they try to take on a bully.
Unless you continually stand up at each point, you become desensitized to what's going on.
But you choose your forum. Like, when mm-hmm. he gets called to testify or when he's in court, there was something to go to the press, to have this be, aired through Colbert and Stephanopoulos as opposed to in a court of law or through a deposition. It's just completely different. I feel like we're seeing that over and over again in the last year and a half, and it's striking that he's fallen into the trap.
The trap that he may be falling into with the book may very well be the same trap he fell into by not following the rules you are arguing that he should fall into before, which is kind of, yes, there are rules. Yes, you should do it this other way. But I kind of know, which then sets up an interesting critique, which could be, okay, we have standards to protect us from people who don't believe the standards exist. But then also standards are in place for those people who are righteous but in error, which is to say we all know when we think we're doing something with God's own faith behind us and it turns out actually we're wrong. Yep. And even though heart is super in the right place.
With all the good intention in the world, you can do a lot of damage.
Right. And so now, having said that, I am a huge fan of huge public conversations about standards falling and why they matter and why these. And I think what he's trying to do in the book, especially by laying out the case of his previous career, is saying, here's how these standards got me through all these previous cases I worked on. And here's the way that, and if they fall away, that's going to have a cost that is huge and big. And we must treat this like a four-alarm fire. Therefore, I must be out everywhere selling this book and talking.
Yes, but it's clearly not having the the opposite effect.
And of course that was going to be the case.
Right. Even Upton Sinclair, when he wrote The Jungle, said, I aimed at people's hearts and I hit him in the stomach. You know, even the great writers in a different time, people misunderstand books.
We did get the Pure Food and Drug Act out of that, I think, out of The Jungle.
But then they get it because people get the Pure Food and Drug Act because people are like, oh my God, I don't want to put this stuff in my gut. Right. They weren't thinking like, oh, poor Jurgis. What was his name? Jurgis? Was that the guy's name?
But the Pure Food, all that food safety stuff was very helpful. It wasn't his point. It didn't bring us socialism
and
the rise of rise of strong rider unions.
I'm glad
but it
that
was
we're
something.
Now having a praise session for Upton Sinclair.
I feel like Comey would have been better off had he just, everything that Ben Wittes writes about Comey is so sympathetic and wonderful, and Ben is a much better advocate for Comey than Comey is for himself.
Right. The vision of Jim Comey that Ben presents is much more appealing.
Okay. Let us go on.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
A viral video of the arrest of two African-American men in a Philadelphia Starbucks has prompted fury at the company and at the Philadelphia police and near universal, in fact, basically universal condemnation. You certainly know the story, but to quickly review, two black men entered a Starbucks near Rittenhouse Square, which is a rich and mostly white Philadelphia neighborhood, correct, Emily?
Yeah, downtown, but the tonier part of downtown.
They were going to wait for a third person to join them for a business meeting. They ordered nothing as they waited. One of them asked to use the bathroom. The manager, seeing they had not ordered, asked them to leave. They did not, but then called the police, who arrived in force, arrested the two men, held them for 9 hours without charge. This encounter was filmed and put up on social media. And almost as soon as it went public, the Starbucks CEO apologized. The manager seems to have been fired, certainly doesn't appear to be working there at that Starbucks anymore. The Starbucks executive chairman, Howard Schultz, declared that he was ashamed of what had happened. The company announced it would close 8,000 stores for a day in May to allow employees to participate in unconscious bias training. It also prompted a flurry of other stories, most of which come without videos, of African-Americans who have been expelled, arrested, otherwise made unwelcome in stores. Is there any explanation for this happening?
Well, I do think it's interesting to think about the conditions that gave rise to this. So if you have a policy where you're denying people access to the bathroom unless they've bought something, you're already setting yourself up. And I just have to say, I say this as a person who wanders around cities like in desperate need of stores that will let me use the bathroom, like regularly, including New York City, including Starbucks in New York City. And there is this whole weird dynamic that we've been trained to feel like we're not allowed to go into the bathroom. Meanwhile, there's no bathrooms anywhere if you're in the urban core of a lot of places. So there's like a setup here to begin with. That would be one way of addressing the problem. And then I think there's this question of what are employees told to do when people sit down and they don't buy something? So are they told to just like kind of keep an eye out for something that looks suspicious? Because if it's that subjective, then you're going to end up with the kind of racial profiling we saw here. If you have actual rules that you're enforcing, then you might be better off. Although I personally am not in favor of rules that treat stores as if they're some like sacred territory and you can't just like sit down and wait for someone for 10 minutes before you order coffee.
But you think you should be allowed to sit down and wait for someone for 10 minutes before you order coffee?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I guess I feel like these coffee shops are playing a role in American society right now where they've essentially become like the place where we all meet and mingle. And they want us there, right? I mean, they're inviting that. And so then to get all strict with us,
right,
selectively, it's always going to be selective who they're strict with.
I was talking to a friend of mine who was this is in a totally different context, but it was evocative. And he was telling me, because we're going to St. Louis, and he was saying, oh, you should go do the Budweiser tour, the Anheuser-Busch
Brewery tour. Yeah, I was excited about that.
Yeah.
And he was saying, well, when I was a kid, it was so great because you could just stay. You could just stay
beer
and drink all you wanted. And so there was a...
It's the Guinness tour.
He was on a tour there and he was saying about how there's this group of winos who clearly, like, you sit through the 90-minute... It's like going to a real estate seminar. You have to sit through the real estate seminar, but then you get to hang out at the hotel. And these guys just then spent the whole day drinking. But he said now they've changed it so you can only stay for 15 minutes. And it's one of these things where probably 99% of the people who go on the brewery tour do not abuse it. And they would happily linger for half an hour and that would be fine and they would have good feelings. But because there are people who abuse it, Anheuser-Busch has said you've got to leave after 15 minutes.
And so you think the people who walk into Starbucks and don't away buy something are...
No. People who are homeless.
I had this experience where I was walking into Union Station. I took a very early train this week up from Washington. So I was at Union Station at 5 a.m. and they're just like homeless people sleeping in Union Station. And it was discomforting. I didn't feel threatened. I mean, but it was disturbing to be in a public space where there was disorder. And like people, disorder is scary. And so you have to, how to balance people's fear of disorder with the our need to create public spaces where people are welcome and private spaces where people are welcome, and also not be racist about it when you're doing it. It's a problem.
I would also argue, though, that there's a deeper structural problem about homeless people, which is that we're not providing enough affordable housing. And so we see this disorder on this one end, but actually, it's attached to all this other.
And so then the question becomes, is this an American story that happened in a Starbucks, which is about everything from homelessness to implicit racial bias, or is it something specific about Starbucks that made this happen?
I don't think it's specific to Starbucks. I think it has to do with coffee shops though, and the role they're playing. So W. Kamau Bell, the comedian, wrote this great essay about getting kicked out of a bookstore cafe in Berkeley.
In Berkeley, of all places.
Because he was showing something to his wife, who happens to be white, and they thought it was a book, and they thought he was trying to sell her something. I mean, it just sounds completely insane. But again, you're in this sort of private-ish space in which the regular behavior of black men is treated as threatening in a way that, it just wouldn't be for the rest of us. And it seems to be, what I find useful about all the moments when this surfaces, because this happens again and again, is it does at least get some people to, think twice, I hope, about the way in which they encounter people, the assumptions they make, and then particularly about calling the police, which remains something that I feel like is a big ramping up of risk and conflict, especially for black Americans, that the rest of us need to really think hard about.
Yeah, well, that takes implicit bias and basically hands it over to the state.
Asks the state to interfere on your side,
right?
I mean, the other thing is, in the end, I'm really glad, by the way, that we don't know the name of the store manager, and I hope that person remains anonymous, because I'm afraid of the intense scapegoating that would come that person's way. I'm glad about all of that, but it's also
true that there were store policies she was probably following. I doubt she was completely out of line with store policies.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I'm sure there is some defense, even if we don't agree with it in the end, but as I understand it, she and other Starbucks employees refused to sign the police complaint, and that's why no charges were brought. Because actually, in Philadelphia, there is this crime. It's called defiant trespassing. If you're asked to leave a private establishment and you don't, you are likely to get charged for a misdemeanor the way these two men were. And I don't think that's a good thing either, but we should recognize that these Starbucks employees did in some ways try to correct their own error.
Why is that not? I mean, I have a genuine question about this. If you run a private business and people are coming and they are either disruptive or they're not customers and they will not leave, how is that not something that the police should be involved in?
Well, maybe the definition of trespassing should have something disruptive in it, so that there is some action that triggers. I don't know. Do you think the private store owner should just be able to throw anyone out for any reason?
I think if someone is not a customer and they are taking space and they're taking business from you effectively by occupying space, won't leave. I mean, I think the idea that person should be charged and go to jail is an incredible waste of resources. But I don't. I mean, what are the other mechanisms? Do you want the store owner to physically expel them?
No, I guess I wonder how much this really comes up. Do we really need the whole might of law enforcement behind this problem of someone's in your store and they're not buying anything and you wish they would leave? Most of the time, shame does work in these situations. People get embarrassed and they will follow the rules if you just ask them. So the notion that we have to have the cops standing there as enforcers
seems dubious.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, going back to the coffee shops or public spaces now question. I mean, one of the things that's happened in American cities, the wonderful revival of American cities has been the creation of all these sort of third spaces. But that's there's so much privilege encoded in that. It's really just for white people.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It does. If spaces are not public, where we have the expectation that they belong equally to everyone, then they are creating a kind of setup for privileging some people over others.
Right. But how does that get solved? I mean, one way it gets solved is by making more public spaces that are nice, having better libraries and community centers and available public bathrooms. But that doesn't. What are the other ways that you solve it?
I don't know how you solve it. Sorry, I was just thinking about the fact that this happens in a context. I'm just thinking about who has a right to beware and who gets challenged on it. And that happens in small ways, like at the Starbucks, but it also happened at a very big national level. And I think you can't deny that it was contributory to the rise of our sitting president, that he essentially suggested that his predecessor was not a legitimate occupant of the office and let me see your papers. So I guess there's the micro of how do you fix this in the moment in Starbucks, but there's also the macro, which is that this is a big national problem. And in this moment, what's the smartest way to elevate those bigger issues so that we're not just figuring out like, how do you take care of people who are there for too long and get us out of the Starbucks store.
Right. So I'm just remembering recently I was in Brooklyn with a couple of young black men and they had to go to the bathroom and so did I. And we had different ideas about where to go. They knew that they could go to McDonald's. Like that was a place where they'd be allowed to use the bathroom. That's they wouldn't have a problem. Whereas I looked around and was like, thought that I had the right to go into any store.
And I think actually McDonald's, I think that's really interesting. I think McDonald's, it's
performing a different role, right? Where poor people do feel like they can use the facilities and sit. But they have rules about how long you can stay.
15 minutes. In D.C., they were looking at this where there's a coffee shop near McDonald's and the coffee shop sort of doesn't expel people to McDonald's. It's sort of you can stay for 15 minutes. It's really fucked up. It's fucked up. This is an area of privilege. I mean, one is constantly reminded of privilege these days because there's so many bad incidents that are coming to light. But this is one that I take advantage of coffee shops all the time. I basically work in coffee shops. You know, I always buy something, but that's also a privilege. It's like, I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever.
But also we tend to buy things that are like under the cost of $5 and then stay for hours, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not me. Every 20 minutes I buy something of increasing value.
You must have like some stack of drinks by you.
by the end of a couple of hours, I'm buying entire coffee machines.
Starbucks is interesting in particular because it's unlike the kind of little twee coffee shop. Starbucks is trying to be a mass audience enterprise. It has thousands and thousands of stores. Not all of them are in the fanciest, most gentrified neighborhoods. They want to be quite universal. And so they're much more a front line for these questions than a lot of places. They actually have to deal with it all the time. And so having seen how they tackle it will be
You know what they really could do is just open up the bathroom. I would be really happy just with that.
Yeah.
Right? They're making a lot of money. Like, should we have public bathrooms? Yes, we should. But we don't. We don't seem to be able to figure out how to incorporate that infrastructure into our center cities. So, like, how about Starbucks, like, steps up and let everyone use the bathroom? And then maybe some other stores could follow suit and all of this, like, locked bathroom, code this, code that, like, could go away. I'd be so happy about
that.
So
much, it is, like, so much fucking misery is around bathroom use.
Yes.
That's right. Anyway. Well, that was a sobering. The whole episode was really sobering. I know I'm very late to the game, but it really just hit me how much I take advantage of this and how much it sucks to be an African American man or woman or probably Latino in a lot of these circumstances.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're not having your Frappuccino cocktail, when you're not having your grande venti martini coffee, John, what will you be chattering about?
I will be chattering about two things. One is not so much a chatter, but a recommendation, which is to read Jeff Bezos's annual letter to shareholders, which he published this week. It is it's just fantastic. I find him fascinating. I'd also like to match his workout routine, but that's because that's not the point of my conversation. It is basically a series of approaches.
The shareholder letter, the workout routine.
No, the workout routine is not in the shareholder letter. It's about customers and people and organizations and learning. And it's just a fascinating look into the clockworks of both his brain, but obviously also Amazon. David talked eloquently about the disruption. Disorder makes you jumpy and uncomfortable. And I think that's one of the reasons a lot of people are jumpy and uncomfortable with the disorder in our White House. Whether you think the president is doing great things or not, it's unavoidable to draw the conclusion that it is a highly disordered White House. And reading this letter to shareholders is a tonic in a sense of it is the considered thinking of a person who's been very successful installing systems, adapting those systems, and building a process for doing something that contributes to a lot of economic growth and personal growth. And anyway, I recommend reading it. The other thing is from the Harvard Business Review. You know me, can't get the Harvard Business Review.
Jeff Bezos, Harvard Business Review.
Oh, yeah. No, I am I'm a fascinating person, trust me.
Sigma Six.
So anyway, I do actually really like the Harvard Business Review. But anyway, there's a section in the Harvard Business Review always called "Defend Your Research," and the one this basically it takes one of those studies that you hear about every 10 seconds about how this or that or the other thing is good or bad for you, and then it makes the researchers defend themselves. And the one that is in this issue is about this study in the Netherlands in which 3,000 volunteers were asked to finish their morning showers with a 30 to 60 or 90 second blast of cold water or to shower and do this for 30 consecutive days. And then they were matched against a group that just showered as they normally did. Then the researchers looked at the work attendance records of those people over that period. And on average, in all the groups that doused themselves with cold water, people were absent 29% fewer days when they had done the cold shower thing.
I think they're all like struggling with PTSD and depression from having to do this torturous thing.
Than the people who took their normal showers. And the conclusion upon investigation and pressing of the researchers, two things I found interesting. One is you don't have to go to the full 90 seconds. The benefits come at 30 seconds, and that it may not necessarily be a health benefit that you get. It's that you feel, because your nervous system has had to go into a crazy thing to create the shivering as it's a result of the 30-second cold shower, that enlivens the body in such a fashion that even if you are sick, you self-report that you're not. So in other words, it doesn't actually make you healthier. It just makes you feel somehow more enlivened.
So you then cause infection to your colleagues.
Right, exactly. So
a recipe for misery. I hate this study.
But what about, I mean, 29% fewer days.
Suggests they're like 100
days. People are missing huge amounts of work all the time.
Well,
for being
apparently,
sick.
Apparently they are.
What if I don't miss, I haven't.
Sure.
Well, then
you're
work.
Then you're fine.
So 29% could be like one less out of three.
I do not. That if you tell me that there's the higher performance, more output, more create widgets, more stories, then I'll listen.
Well, here's the thing.
Showing up at work does not seem an interesting discovery.
Well, here's what's potentially interesting. You are something of an Iron Man, and let's say there are those days you go to the work and you don't not go to work, but you feel a little low, a little crappy. What if the taking of the cold shower would, on those days, elevate you to a more energetic disposition?
I think David wants to see those findings. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he's not as sensitive.
Do you see what I'm saying? It's not.
What I would say is there are plenty of tools I have in my own life to give me a little bit of energy, mostly involving if I'm feeling
bubble
a little down,
tea.
I'll go for a walk.
Yeah, sure.
I will take a walk around the corner, and that will put the blood flowing.
But what if you could add this to your regimen? And then you'd be even more in good shape.
I would have to be convinced that I was getting some extremely concrete and significant benefit out of this. It sounds awful to me.
Here's the final and true word about this, which is having tried this on a few days, it is torture and should not be done by anyone. It is awful.
Oh, good.
Promoting it with such a straight face for the last 5 minutes.
Oh, it is dreadful.
I want to know what diabolical person even thought that this was like a good thing to test.
But I think it's
why not test like walking around the block?
Well, I had to test this theory. The problem is having control over it because the apartment I'm staying in until we find housing someday in New York Con Edison is apparently having issues, and they don't turn the water back on until 5 a.m., which is when I leave to go to the office. And so I had a couple of instances where I had to, and sorry, they don't turn the hot water back on.
Okay. Oh, my God.
So I have had to, now taking an entire shower in freezing cold is really no picnic.
It's like the worst thing ever.
Yeah. Although I have a low,
more than anything.
I have a low opinion of picnics. So anyway, but it's
so you like show up on the set of CBS This Morning and you are either dirty
or freezing.
No. Since I have a healthy sense of shame, I'm not dirty. I'm just really cold. And
oh my God, I would totally be dirty. 100%.
I have people writing in to tell me about the color of my teeth and the kind
of
tie.
But they can't smell you.
No, I understand that. But I guess, and the kind of tie I wear.
So you need to feel at least internally.
Your teeth are not, for somebody who is on television, you just have regular teeth.
So that's the story of my experiment with the Norwegian freezing cold showers.
Emily, what is your chatter?
I am really interested in a letter that Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of the State of New York, wrote to Governor Cuomo and the legislature this week asking for help. Schneiderman wants them to pass a bill that would clarify under New York state law that if, oh, just perchance, Donald Trump went around pardoning people of federal crimes, that Schneiderman could still indict them for state crimes. And the issue here is, so there is a federal, and every state has a double jeopardy clause. You can't get prosecuted for the same crime twice. That's great. That's really important. But New York also has this other thing called Article 40, which essentially says that the double jeopardy attaches when a defendant pleads guilty or goes to a jury trial or even the moment the jury is sworn. And there are exceptions in the rule, like if the case doesn't proceed because of a court action, but it never says in here that there's an exception if a presidential pardon is issued, because surely like they just didn't think of it. And so Schneiderman just wants Cuomo and the legislature to make it clear that anyone pardoned by the president of a federal crime law could not say that because of double jeopardy, they can't be prosecuted in the state of New York.
But why would the state charge be this? Wouldn't the state intrinsically charge something different than the federal crime?
Yes, but apparently the way this Article 40 is worded, it's not clear that a state crime that's parallel. Oh, right. There was in here too. If it's for the same actions, the same set of actions. Okay. So it's much broader than our usual notion of double jeopardy.
Isn't there some theory that Mueller or federal prosecutors may not charge everything they have in part to leave that open for the states?
Yeah, I mean, that is possible. And it is another way of dealing with the president's pardon power and potentially the constitutional problem of indicting the president under federal law, although that is a dicier proposition.
I want to chatter about a great New York Times story about the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke. It's interesting. It's a lot about Zinke's history. And in Montana, he was really known as an environmentalist and a conservationist within the state. He's come to office as Secretary of the Interior, and he's really made a reputation for opening public lands and diminishing protections on public lands, opening public lands to natural gas and oil exploration in particular, and opening it to mining. But what the story points out is that in Montana, under Zinke's secretaryship, he has protected lands in that state. So he's halted the sale of oil and gas leases near Yellowstone. He opposed some gold mining. He's created a national monument in Montana, and he's pushing to create another one that's just miles from his childhood home. So it's somebody who is for the rest of the country, for thee, he's all like, yeah, let's mine and drill and despoil public lands. But in my backyard, in my state where I want to run for governor and I want to build my political career, I'm going to protect the land because I know that it's right and I know that's what the people of my state want. And so it's a minor hypocrisy. And God knows I'm happy for the public lands in Montana to be protected. It's a beautiful state and I'm all for it. But it's depressing that he's acting in this way. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. You can follow us on Twitter at SlateGabFest. Please, we'll ask you for questions again this week on social media, and we would love for you to send us questions for For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. Come to our St. Louis show, slate.com/live, for tickets to our May 2nd show in St. Louis, and we'll talk to you before then.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.